Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with Rebecca Watson. I'm featuring an interview that Rebecca and I recorded with Victor J. Stenger. Vic Stenger is Emeritus Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Hawaii and an Adjunct Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado. Stenger was a pioneer in the emerging research focused on neutrino astronomy and very high energy gamma rays. His final research project prior to retirement as an experimental physicist was participating in the Japan-based Super Kamiokande underground experiment, which demonstrated that the neutrino has mass and which won its leader the 2002 Nobel Prize for Physics. Nowadays, Stenger is principally known as a critic and skeptic of intelligent design and other ideas of pseudoscience. He is also skeptical about fine-tuning of cosmological constants. He has published a number of books intended for a general audience on the subjects of physics and cosmology, philosophy, religion and pseudoscience, such as God, the Failed Hypothesis, Not by Design, and most recently, New Atheism.
Neil and I are joined by Victor Stenger. Victor, thank you so much for having us over to your London flat to chat today.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here.
We want to start by talking about your latest book, which is about the new atheism. Why don't you tell us about the book, about what you cover in that?
All right, well, I was trying to, number one, tell people what the new atheism was about, but also to some extent defend it, because there were an enormous number of books that came out in response to this series of bestsellers, starting with Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, and myself. Most of them were in response to Dawkins, because Dawkins' book was by far the biggest blockbuster of the group. It's already sold three million copies in English. He's also probably the best known of all of us, but also to some extent Hitchens, and then of course Harris. So there were any number of books. You could go to Amazon and search on New Atheism, and you'll see dozens of books with New Atheism in the title, most by Christian apologists, most out of these Christian publishing houses. I went through a lot of them. They tend to be just, not very scholarly. Half of them don't have indices, and they're poorly referenced. But anyway, I felt like I had to answer some of the issues that they were raising. And so that was, after just briefly mentioning what was in the New Atheist books, I go into quite a bit of reviewing of some of the criticisms and trying to answer them. For example, the typical kind of criticism that was really quite common was that science is based on faith, just like religion. I can't tell you how many times I heard that, and it also was in these books. Because one of the big arguments of the New Atheism is that faith is foolish, that faith shouldn't be trusted. Why should it be trusted? Because it's based on a total lack of data or reason. If it wasn't, it wouldn't be faith. It would be an argument. And so people came back and say, well, science is the same way. And so I wanted to argue that science wasn't the same way, that science was not based on faith. Science is based on evidence. Science is based on reason. And furthermore, you had the reason why we take science seriously, the reason why we believe science is the best we can do in learning about the world is because it's been so successful, because it works. And it's for a practical reason. That's the other argument people would give, that you can't prove. You can't come up with a logical argument proving that science is the best way to learn about the world, because you've got to use data to do that. And I said, yeah, you can use data to do that. We can't prove logically that science is the best way to do things. All we can do is say, look at the world, look at what science has done for us, and so that's why we believe that we should trust science before faith. So that was sort of the first part of good first part of the book is along those lines.
Can we come back a bit later to the science part, because I want to talk about your previous book, God, the Failed Hypothesis, mm-hmm. as well a little bit. But what in essence is different about New Atheism, beyond the fact that, you know, it could be argued that canny publishers have seen a good bandwagon and seen how the God delusion did.
Yeah.
What makes this a movement? Why is New Atheism different to classical atheism?
Oh, yeah, well, it is true that a lot of long-time atheists objected to the term. Certainly, none of us gave it that terminology. That was something that came out of the media, I suppose. I don't know. But it was used to identify this series of best-selling books, six books by five authors, and it was something that a lot more people were learning. What was different, first of all, was a lot more people were finding out about atheism. People who certainly couldn't all have been hard-nosed atheists, yet they were buying these books, and so that was a difference. And what was it that they were saying? They were saying a much more hard-nosed attitude against religion, right from the beginning with Sam Harris's book, The End of Faith. I mean, he's saying we should look toward the end of faith, not just the right-wing fundamentalist faith, but even the moderate faith, because the moderate faiths are encouraging the terrorism and everything just by promoting irrational beliefs. They still hold to irrational beliefs, and we shouldn't be hesitant to criticize them. And that was the other aspect that we feel like, especially in the U.S., religion is given special treatment that we think is actually illegal and certainly unconstitutional. I mean, the churches get tax benefits. Clergymen get tax benefits that are not available to anyone who's not affiliated with a church. Other non-profit organizations get tax breaks, but they don't get the same ones. And so that has to be unconstitutional, has to violate the First Amendment. And so, and then, of course, on top of that, you have the federal government giving money to church-based organizations, and at the same time, these organizations do things like, not only do they use the money for proselytizing, they also use the money for politicizing. They perform political actions that also is forbidden. No nonprofit organization, certain kinds of nonprofit organizations can politicize, but can do politics. But they pay more taxes than the ones who don't. So there's all of this, we think, special treatment that they get. Of course, people of faith are also treated with higher regard. They're assumed to have some special knowledge about morality. Clergymen are always called in to testify in government on moral issues as if they had some special knowledge of morality. And we protest this. We say, no, they don't have any. Just by having faith, that doesn't mean you know anything. And we don't think that the big point, of course, is that morality doesn't come from religion. We think morality comes from humanity and picked up by religions, perhaps, but many of the teachings of the scriptures we regard as immoral. And so I think you know all that story, and your listeners probably have heard that before. And maybe that's what some of the critics have said is, well, we've all heard that before, but that's true. But maybe not everybody who was reading these books had heard it before. It was really new for a lot of people.
I think those are all valid reasons to combat religion, but let's talk a bit about the new atheist way of going about that. I think a really common assertion you hear both from theists as well as from other atheists and from other non-believers is the problem of taking an aggressive approach. And some say that it's driving away moderate believers to helping out with the cause. How do you feel about that?
Okay, well, here's the way I answer this. First of all, I have no problem with working with moderate believers on common issues such as making sure that evolution is taught properly in the schools and creationism isn't taught. We can work together. I think in any movement, any kind of revolution, and I think we are involved in a revolution here, and any kind of revolution needs both people working within the system and without the system. So they can do that. And as long as we keep our criticism on an intellectual basis, you know, sometimes we fail, but I haven't personally been accused in my writing of being insulting or overly polemical. You'd be a little bit polemical. That's not that bad.
We're okay with polemics every now and again.
Yeah, but you shouldn't accuse people of being stupid. You shouldn't accuse people of being dishonest, and especially dishonest because it'll get you sued. I've been sued by people for saying a lot less in my book, and so you stick to intellectual arguments, and then the believers have no reason to complain, no reason why they can't still work with you and then have their arguments with you on an intellectual level. And believe me, I have had, in all the years I've been writing against religion and against paranormal beliefs and so on, I have had no personal attacks, no threats of violence. The only violence at all that's ever happened and associated with my writing was when I was in Canada giving a talk on God, the Failed Hypothesis, when Justin Trottier, who's the Center for Inquiry director in Toronto, was beaten up by somebody while he was posting my notice. I'm proud to say that it was in Canada, not in the U.S., that there was this violence. And he got a bloody nose and everything from it. And that was the only incident. I had plenty of people, you can imagine, write me letters telling me how wrong I am and why I'm wrong, and that's fine. I mean, that's obviously fair for the game, so that, it can be done. I think it can be done. That I think Dawkins and Hitchens could have been a little bit more easygoing than they have been. Harris hasn't been that objectionable, I think, to anybody. But just stick to the arguments. That's all we have to do.
Let's go back to one of the points that you've already raised that is one of the sort of key new atheist tenets, and this is the idea that faith is foolish, inherently foolish. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about in what ways.
Yeah, that was actually the very first point that I was beginning to talk about, that we think this is definitely an upfront position that is different from what has been kind of traditionally a position traditionally taken by non-believers who tried to be accommodating and so on. And that is that there's no basis for taking a person of faith and saying they have any special insight to provide. You have to believe that there's truth of some sort in their way of getting knowledge by revelation or through scriptures, which I guess is part of revelation. And so, yeah, I mean, if there were if revelation really existed, then they would have a point. They would say, well, God's telling me this stuff. And that's, of course, what they do say, and that's what the Catholic Church claims. And that's why I use the argument, going back to God, the Failed Hypothesis, that revelation is a very good example of the kind of phenomenon that you would expect from God, who plays such an active role in the world as the God of the Jews, Christians, and Muslims, that God is supposed to reveal truths and talk to people. And you know, all you have to do, this is the easiest thing in the world to test. All you have to do is find someone who came back with some information they could not have possibly known ahead of time, and that could later be tested in a nice, careful, scientific way and found to be true. You couldn't, if it was sufficiently unusual, like a prediction of some event that the person couldn't possibly have predicted by any scientist could have predicted, like a tsunami on a certain date, you know, that sort of thing. Then that would be real evidence. And you would think by now that in the thousands of years that people have made such claims, there would have been something predictable that they could have happened. Now, of course, there have been claims of that sort in the scriptures, the prophecies, but they don't hold up. You look at them and they don't hold up. So there really hasn't been anything that you could test has passed the test.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and with Rebecca Watson, and we're talking to Victor Stenger. So, Vic, carrying on this idea about ways to scientifically test for an existence of God, I've read in your writing that you say that, you know, it's quite easy to admit and say that we can't absolutely prove that there is a God, but it seems perfectly reasonable to be able to prove, as in a sort of court of law type proof, to be able to prove beyond reasonable doubt that there isn't a God. So that's
I'm trying to avoid the association with symbolic logic or with formal logic, I guess is the term, where you have you make an assumption and then you prove something based on that assumption. You really learn nothing from that. Ask any philosopher and they'll tell you that you learn nothing. You learn nothing from the deductive process that's not already there. And so we're talking about trying to learn something. How do you learn something? And the only way we know that has proved to be successful so far has been observation, scientific observation, but also everyday observation. We live our lives learning things by observation.
Well, one of the ways in which you've pointed out that we could search for the existence of God through scientific observation is through the power of prayer to heal people. So let's talk about how we would do that.
Well, that's kind of interesting because one of the problems that one of the criticisms I've had of national science organizations, including the National Academy of Sciences in particular, which is the elite of American scientists, only 7% of whom believe in a personal God. So these are all non-believers for the most part, and they tell you, they say, oh, but you can't, science can say nothing about God. And again, they're just doing that to make sure to keep from getting in trouble politically. It's just a total political position that is not based on the facts. It's really disingenuous of them to say that, because right around their own ears, you have scientists from major universities like Duke University and Harvard, and also Mayo Clinic, doing well-designed, careful experiments on prayer and whether prayer can provide some healing benefit. And there's a whole institution in Duke University headed by Dr. Harold Koenig, whom I happen to know fairly well and have a lot of respect for. He's a good scientist. He's an honest man. But he's also a believer. And his institute is trying to show that, that religion is good for you. He collects a lot of data, not just on prayer, but on anything, but on religious behavior, going to church versus not going to church, and how do people go to church? Do they do better than people who don't go to church? And the answer is they do. But my response to that is, well, that's because people who are sick can't go to church, so you have to. In any case, they have done a series of prayer experiments that there have been a lot of experiments being that were previously done that were very poor quality, but these last three sets of experiments were excellent, and they came up negative. And these scientists who were involved were good scientists, honest scientists. Every one of the ones that proved God existed, but they were willing to go where the data went. Okay, so they. That was the result. Now, I don't use that as an argument that God doesn't exist. Just the fact that these experiments did not come up with prayer. The way I phrase the argument is that if they had been positive, they could have proven. So those people who say science can't prove God exists, I've already given you one example by revelation, proving something by revelation. Also, you could prove God exists if there had been a positive result of prayer studies. Now, I've been very specific on that. I said, suppose that the prayers of Catholics worked and Protestant prayers didn't work, and Muslim prayers and Hindu prayers, only Catholic prayers worked. Well, then, I could not come up with natural explanation for that, any plausible natural explanation, so you would have to start taking this seriously. And believe me, if you got results like this, you'd have many scientists willing to take up research on this. Because, first of all, they would get funded. That's the most important thing. You have a research scientist is funding. You can't do any research without funding. That's how you buy the toys and can afford nice trips around the world, the conferences, and nice dinners and good wine. And that's that's part of the nice features about being a research scientist, who's well-funded. So that would be evidence. And now I say, now look at the accumulated evidence over thousands of years, billions of prayers. You think sometime there should have been some prayer that would have, certainly people believe that prayers are answered. You think there would have been some cases where there was no denying that prayer worked out. This would be easiest to do with the controlled scientific experiment, and if you just had anecdotal stories, which you do have, they're usually not very good. But if you had enough of the same nature and they began to pile up along certain lines, then you could do controlled experiments along those lines, and maybe you could eventually, and you should have eventually, come up with evidence. So that was another one. And in general, my arguments are that if the universe had been created by a god who plays an active role, that there are many examples, design, there should have been examples in the creation cosmos, in biological systems, there should have been cases, some sign of that, and a god who would deliberately hide it from us would be an immoral god, because there is a god who is condemning people to eternity and hell because they didn't grovel at his feet. Bertrand Russell used the argument that people would say to him, "Well, what'll you say to God if God has you up in front of him at Judgment Day?" And he said, "Well, I'll just have to say, God, you just didn't give me enough evidence." So the argument is that God would have to be an immoral God to hide from. He could hide from us, but that would be an immoral God. That would not be the God, again, that most people worship, because most people worship a moral God. Mm-hmm. So it's that series of arguments. Basically, the universe looks very much like it should look if there is no God. Cosmology looks like it should look. Physics looks like it should look. Biology looks like it should look. Everything, every place you go in science, it looks just like it should look. The brain, neuroscience... Yeah, it's just everything is coming out godless.
That immoral God you speak of, that really does seem to be the God that most people believe in, just because, you know, when these prayer studies are done and come up negative, it seems that the overwhelming response is, you know, well, sometimes God says no, or God works in mysterious ways, or God must have faith, and proving he exists would ruin the whole point of the faith. How do you deal with a God that ducks and weaves so deftly in people's minds?
Well, you just say, okay, well, maybe God's a bad God. Maybe God's an evil God. An evil God certainly fits the data a lot better than a good God. Because you have this whole problem of evil in the world. I mean, that's never been answered by a theologian.
You just raised the idea that all of the evidence looked at across the board points to the direction that it's a godless universe. But nonetheless, a lot of people would argue, people that don't believe in God, would argue that somehow that universe is still fine-tuned for the existence of ourselves, for the existence of life. And you're quite a harsh critic of this anthropic principle. So shall we perhaps talk about why?
Well, the whole reason I even do what I do can be traced back to the early 80s when I started reading things like Skeptical Inquirer and so on, and found how much science was being misused to make claims about various kinds of phenomena. In that case, it was mostly psychic phenomena, but I quickly saw that religion was also, people were also using claims from science to support the existence of God. You have the whole series of cosmological claims that I've talked about a lot. And then you have this fine-tuning argument that the constants of the or parameters, I prefer to call them, because you're allowing them to vary. These parameters of nature, of physics in particular, or cosmology, but those are also physics parameters. Physics is the basis here. If they changed even by the tiniest amount, you wouldn't have life as we know it. So, therefore, life so unlikely to have occurred by accident. Now, that unlikely argument already is incorrect, because you can't compare, just calculate something and say it has a low probability and therefore include it. It doesn't happen, because what's the probability of Rebecca existing? I mean, what's the probability of a particular sperm met a particular egg and her parents met and her grandparents met, and you trace it all the way back to the bacteria that came together to produce it a billion years ago?
I mean, I'm easily one in a zillion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you calculate the a priori probability of any of us existing, it's infinitesimally small. So you have to, I mean, the point is, things with low a priori probability happen all the time.
So you're not saying that the universe was made just for me, because I was kind of getting that.
No, because whether you could draw that conclusion, even though the point is something had to happen, you know. And after the fact, the probability that you exist is 100%. So that's the difference between the a priori and posteriori probability. So you can't just calculate a low probability for something, even if you could calculate it. They don't really know how to calculate these fine-tuning probabilities anyway. But even if you could calculate it, come up with a small number, you have to calculate the probability for the alternative and then compare the two. And there's a no-brainer explanation for all this, and that is that there are multiple universes. Modern cosmology suggests that there are multiple universes, and we just again happen to be in the one that suited for us, with the properties necessary to have life of our sort to evolve. Now, and that could end it right there, but except that the theologians and theists and apologists will say, well, you can't really prove the existence of those or demonstrate the existence of those universes. It's not good science to talk about things you can't observe. That, incidentally, is wrong. We talk about things we can't observe all the time in science, and it's perfectly good science to do so. Nobody's ever seen a quark. A quark's a fundamental part of our theories today. In fact, it's kind of interesting. The theory not only says you can't see a quark, but also says you'll never see a quark. You'll never see a bare quark. I mean, and if you did, you would have to change your theories. That's how basic that is. So we deal with the unobservable all the time. However, in a new book that I'm working on now called The Fallacy of Fine-Tuning, I try to stick just to our universe, those claims that are made with respect to our universe, and show that every one of them has a plausible explanation within the framework of existing knowledge. And I could give specific examples, but we probably don't have time for that. So you'll have to buy the book to see what those are.
That was very savvy. I think you're going to bankrupt your fans, though, because it seems that you're putting out a book maybe twice a year now or so.
No.
You're pretty prolific at this point.
Well, I didn't put out anything yet in 2010, and this one won't be out till 11.
Oh, all right. Well, Vic, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'm sure our readers are looking forward to learning more about everything we discussed in one of your books.
And I will just say that you have got a book coming out in 2010, because according to Amazon, The New Atheism is released here at the beginning of July, so that's one for listeners to look out for.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Vic.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.